This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Vampires, deadly spiders, lethal lasers, out-of-control asteroids. Who knew that math could be so perilous?
Now, this is a do-or-die scenario, so you've got to do some mathematics.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of the book of Perfectly Perilous Math and find out how kids are having fun learning math while saving the world. Or not. We'll also hear about efforts to rebuild a school damaged in a deadly tornado last year. Hear music from a school that uses the melodies of foreign countries to teach immigrants about their heritage. And we'll also find out why the space between the musical notes may be just as important as the music. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Let's say a vampire has moved onto your block, and every month he feeds on two people in your town, turning them into vampires. Follow me now. 1 month later, he and each of the new vampires are capable of turning two more people into vampires. Approximately how many months will it take for your 500,000-person town to be populated entirely by blood-sucking fiends if they're not stopped? This is just one of the earth-shattering math dilemmas in The Book of Perfectly Perilous Math, 24 death-defying challenges for young mathematicians. I recently spoke with Sean Connolly, the author of this unique new take on math. Sean also wrote a couple of fun books dealing with science, so I asked him how different it was approaching math as opposed to science.
Well, you know, that was, it's interesting you should say that. There's one common theme running through it. All three books, that is, and that is, if you like, a kind of collaboration with my three kids, and in particular, twins who are now in their, well, their teens now, but they were about nine when I started doing the science books. And this is boy-girl twins, so we're talking scientific experiments to do with gender stereotypes and whether my daughter was as scared of math as she claimed to be and her brother was as able. So the math and the science were always intertwined in my own mind. It just happens that the first two books that came out of that gestation were science books.
Have we decided by now that the average middle schooler needs more stimulation than the average math textbook can supply?
I think so. You can tie yourself up in knots to do when you look at figures about OECD countries and percentage of proficiency students in eighth grade or equivalent, and the United States sometimes, well, I'd say consistently, comes middle of the rankings there, which is a source of some disappointment for many people because they'll say, oh, it's next to Slovakia or something like that. Partly that's a bit of an unfair comparison because we're comparing countries that probably don't have the breadth of educational availability. So it's you're looking private schools in some countries versus all of America. That's the good news. The bad news is I think that kids probably are, it's not so much the textbooks or the teachers. They're both great, I think. It's the fact there's a lot of competition out there, so you really need to have something that comes from a slightly quirky left-field angle. That's my view.
As you approach this, what grade level were you looking for?
Well, the two science books really gave me an idea of the sort of, because I've done book tours in each case pretty extensively across the country, and, you know, I get people coming up, whether it's parents who've bought the book or when I go to schools. The peak age is probably grades 5 and 6, but it goes from about grades 4 to 7. And the math that's involved in these challenges, that which are basically the tasks involved, call on the math skills that they would have learned during those periods, grades 4 to 7.
Well, you do have 24 challenges in this new book. Tell us about the challenges and how much input did your kids have to them?
Well, they had a fair bit, in fact. It started out with my recollection of word problems going back to when I was learning math in grade school. And maybe you had some of these too, or maybe some of your listeners. The trains leaving Chicago, arriving in Philadelphia, one goes at 40 miles an hour, that sort of thing. And you seem to have them year in, year out, where the kids who were very able, I think, were probably bored silly. And then the ones who were a bit daunted to begin with, it turned them off. So We were looking for something that was kind of quirky to start with. So these are word problems in the sense that that's a skill in itself, being able to discern the mathematics within the words, because it's not just numbers being thrown. So that was part of it. But my kids, we were talking about, we'd be talking about a movie about vampires they've just seen. I thought that might be an idea for exponential growth. Yeah, yeah, like that. And then we'd sort of bounce the ideas back and forth. So yeah, there was a lot of collaboration.
So you did. You included vampire stories, and tell us about some of the challenges.
Well, we've got, here's another one that's, some of them are do or die. So you've got, you're a scuba diver, you're looking for buried treasure, and you know that you've pinpointed the wreck of a famous pirate, not Bluebeard, but Redbeard, down at the foot of the Caribbean Sea. You've got the jump on the gun on your competitors, who are also out after these very famous jewels and swords and scabbards. Down you go. You're in a hurry. You go down to about 200 feet depth, scuba tanks on. You're looking around. Things are looking good, and you realize you've left the computer, the wrist computer that's meant to tell you when to go back and how fast because of the bends. So you've got to do some mathematics to work out how long you can actually stay down there on the ocean floor before you have to come back up. Now, this is a do-or-die scenario, so it's not just, it is a bit wacky and it's a bit cool, I guess, but we all know that there are fatalities in poor calculations like that. So this is a chance to realize that what you've just read and might have captured your interest would still have a really, really do-or-die element to it.
Have you gotten feedback from teachers that these books are being used in school, or it's really capturing their students' attention?
Well, it's a little bit early days now because the book has only been out officially just over a month. In fact, if I tell you it came out on March 14th, which is 314, which is Pi Day, so that was a bit of significance with the publishers, and I certainly okayed that.
Nicely done.
Yeah, it was a bit of good timing there. So we're getting some feedback coming through saying that it's already not a textbook per se, so much as an adjunct. You know, the teachers will hold it up and say this is a neat way of exploring some of the things we've just been talking about. So yes, I think the fact that it does closely, and this is where my editors were playing a very central role, they made sure I didn't stray from the Common Core standards in mathematics. So I didn't throw integral calculus or something like that as a kind of curveball.
Well, you did somehow conflate Monty Hall and Let's Make a Deal to the theory of probability. So, you know, there's
that's true. I'm glad you picked that one up. Yes, I love that sort of thing. And I love the fact that, you know, afternoon television, you know, pyramids, zombies, there's a mathematical twist or core to a lot of these things. So it's amazing to realize that you can actually, if you view the world through that prism, then a lot becomes clearer.
I asked about feedback from teachers for this book. How about the science books? Did you get much feedback from those?
Yes, I did. And one of the nice things there was the fact that, and this again hit home fair and square, because with boy-girl twins, if I heard this once, I must have heard it a dozen times, people would come up and say, this is a book that gets girls interested in science and boys interested in reading. So, you know, that's something. And I have to admit that my daughter is the one, she could probably tell you every single Jane Austen book, you know, back to front, Gone with the Wind, Louisa May Alcott. That, her brother, I think, has read the Guinness Book of World Records and my books. That's about it, factual stuff, you know. So it's really good to get that. And when you get kids who feel that they weren't, or felt that they weren't confident in science, coming up and saying that they just did one experiment after the other and had a blast. You know, that's great.
Well, you've done two science books, now a math book. What's next?
Well, I suppose ancient Greek looms ahead of me, or or maybe we've just passed April 15th. Maybe some sort of how to do your tax return without getting a nervous breakdown. But no, I think I might be. I'm not going to jinx things, but there's perhaps a way of synthesizing some of the things that I've just been doing. It's a return to science with a bit more of an overview. But as I said, mum's the word until it's official.
Again, the name of Sean Connolly's new book is The Book of Perfectly Perilous Math, 24 Death-Defying Challenges for Young Mathematicians. Sean is also the author of The Book of Totally Irresponsible Science and The Book of Potentially Catastrophic Science. Last June, a pair of tornadoes ripped through the city of Springfield, Massachusetts, leaving 4 people dead and dozens injured. Now, almost a year later, officials in Springfield announced they intend to seek state and federal funding to build a new school to replace an old one that was heavily damaged by the storm. The best of our knowledge's Paul Tuttle reports.
The Elias Brookings School, which dates to 1925, was rendered unusable after the tornado blew out all of the windows and punched holes in the roof of the 3-story brick building. Springfield Mayor Dominic Sardo says city officials have concluded it makes sense, both economically and educationally, to build a replacement.
We have an opportunity here not only to continue to redefine education, we have an opportunity to continue to highlight the positiveness of the neighborhood and redefine a neighborhood area.
Sarno said officials are looking at potential sites for a new school within a few blocks of the old one. City officials will go before the Massachusetts School Building Authority next month to ask the state to cover up to 80% of the cost to design and construct the new school. The project may also be eligible for partial reimbursement from the Federal Emergency Management Agency because last year's tornado resulted in a presidential disaster declaration. A new school is estimated to cost $28 million, according to Rita Coppola Wallace, the city's director of capital assets and construction. It would cost slightly less, she says, to repair the damage to the old school.
So financially, it was deemed that you're still at the end of the day, you could put millions into this building, you're still left with a 1925-year-old school that isn't big enough to accommodate the educational programs.
Springfield's chief development officer, Kevin Kennedy, says a new school building could also provide a lift to the tornado-scarred Maple High Six Corners neighborhood, where blue tarps still drape many of the houses and apartment buildings.
The process is going to move forward, and we can assure everybody that we're going to have a great new school here, and we will also have a housing strategy to deal with some of the devastation behind you.
The target date for opening the new school is the fall of 2015. That will mean an extended stay in modular classrooms for the Brookings School's 300 kindergarten through sixth grade students. Principal Terry Poe says the modular classrooms erected on the school's former playground have been a fine stopgap.
They are clean, spacious. Some of the rooms are a lot bigger than what we had in our old building. Some of the children complain about not having a cafeteria and a gymnasium, so those are some of the challenges that we've had to deal with. But other than that, we've tried to keep the children focused. We're doing our job every day.
The city is making repairs to a second school that was damaged by the tornado. The Roman Catholic Diocese of Springfield is planning to rebuild tornado-ravaged Cathedral High School. The diocese has gone to arbitration with its insurance company to resolve an impasse over the damage claim. Springfield's mayor has made an urgent appeal to FEMA and state authorities to pay the city's expenses to remove large piles of tree debris that remain on private property. There's concern about fire. Earlier this month, a brush fire in a tornado-damaged area in Brimfield burned up 50 acres. No buildings were damaged. But Mayor Sardo says it would be a different story if such a fire hit Springfield.
Here will be affected hundreds and hundreds of homes and thousands of people. It's been so dry.
The city estimates it will cost $7 million to remove the storm debris that remains still on private property. Reporting from Springfield, I'm Paul Tuthill.
Still to come, a school that's filled with music is preserving culture for families of immigrants. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9260. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1128. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. In Mexico, folk music does more than just entertain. It's kind of an oral history, a way to preserve and pass on stories about life and communities. Children of Latino immigrants in the U.S. are often caught between the two cultures. Traditional music can help them connect with their Mexican roots. That's the goal of a Mexican art center in San Pablo, California, and it's having quite a bit of success. Madeline Baer from the World Vision Report has the story.
The message is as clear as the notes of the tuba in the song Soy México Americano, off the newest album of Los Sensones.
Por mi madre yo soy mexicano, por destino soy americano, yo soy de la raza de oro, yo soy México Americano.
Because of my mother, I am Mexican. Because of my destiny, I am American. I am from the golden people. I am Mexican-American. The lyrics of this ranchera extol the pride of knowing two languages and two cultures. But for many Mexican-Americans, finding pride in a dual identity is not so simple. Take Lucina Rodriguez, one of the singers on this track.
I was born in Guadalajara. I was raised in Santa Anita till I was 11 years old, and then I came to this country, and I did not like being in this country.
From central Mexico, Lucina's family settled in San Pablo, a small working-class town across the bay from San Francisco. There was a new language, different food, and Latino gangs that caught recent immigrants in their crosshairs.
And so you really, you know, would walk on the streets with a lot of fear that you're going to get jumped, you know, and not because I'm a gangster, but just because I'm dark.
Outside of her home, Lucina found one place in town where she could let her guard down, Los Sensones Mexican Arts Center. It's named after the Nahuatl word for mockingbirds, because its classes in music and arts span the gamut of Mexican folk tradition. Much of it was new to Lucina.
Even though I come from a family of musicians, I didn't listen to traditional music. I didn't like rancheras.
Lucina wanted to sing like the pop stars she heard on the radio, but to tour with the center's performance group, she was required to practice the traditional Mexican styles.
As I got involving into it, I realized how beautiful it was, and then I really learned to appreciate it and love it.
That was 16 years ago. Today, Lucina is helping a new generation of students to embrace their culture. It's easy to miss Los Sensones. The center is tucked into a strip mall on San Pablo's main street. Across the way is a casino, and a laundromat sits next door. The location seems more suitable for a liquor store, which in fact it was before Los Sensones moved in.
Yeah, you take him out, and then...
But walk through the doors on a weekday afternoon, and it reverberates with life. The sound of boot heels bounces off the wooden floor. In the spacious main room, Lucina strums an 8-stringed Mexican guitar called a jarana and leads 7 children in Son Jarocho, a dance that originated on the slave plantations of Veracruz. Lucina's evolution from student to performer to teacher is exactly what musician Eugene Rodriguez envisioned when he created Los Sensones 2 decades ago. Since then, hundreds of kids have taken classes, and dozens have performed on its albums, including the new Raza de Oro, which means golden people. Eugene, who is not related to Lucina, says the mission goes beyond arts education.
They hear music in their homes or in their parents' homes or their grandparents' homes that they develop a relationship with. Now, they may not acknowledge that relationship necessarily because they are listening to hip-hop or rock or whatever, but there's a point in their life when they start to say, okay, what does this sound mean to me?
For Maria Ramirez, that point came at an early age. The 14-year-old has been coming to Los Sensones for 10 years. She says most of her Mexican-American friends don't know much about their heritage. Not Maria.
I started with dance, and from there I started doing Jarocho and Jalisquense. Then I started singing for a little while, but I stopped, and I've been doing a lot of percussion with the quijada, the pandero, the congas, and the drums.
The quijada is a donkey jawbone, the pandero, a tambourine. And it can be heard on Maria's favorite song she learned here, Voy Caminando, or I Go Walking.
It's telling pretty much the journey and the story of a man who's coming from Mexico and is immigrating to America here, but he's leaving behind his parents, his family, his, what he calls it, ranchito verde, which is like his land.
It's a story she could relate to. That journey is what brought her father to San Francisco, far from his native Durango. But until learning that song, Maria and her father had never talked about it.
I used to think that he just drove here. He just drove here from Mexico, but I told him about the song, and then he told me about how he came here and what he left behind.
6 years ago, he took his family back home, where Mireya surprised her cousins with Durango dance moves that she learned in California.
Because they thought that coming from America here, that I wouldn't know none of the traditions from over there. But I did, because I came here to Los Angeles.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Madeline Baer.
Adiós solo le pedía que un día volver a verle.
And again, Madeline's story comes to us from the World Vision Report.
Sometimes the most important thing about music is what you don't hear. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. If asked, you might be hard-pressed to find someone who doesn't enjoy music in some form or style. But while listening to music is one of life's simple pleasures, the process of perceiving music is neurologically complex. Elizabeth Helmuth Margulis, an associate professor and director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, explains.
Here's something that happens. You're listening to a piece of music. It's drawing you further and further in, getting more and more exciting when... nothing. A long pause. Yet that silence can sound more fraught than many a passage full of notes. Participants in a set of experiments at my lab responded differently to the same period of silence, depending on the musical context in which it was embedded. By surrounding the pause with the right kind of music, I could make listeners think it was longer or shorter, or judge it as tenser or more relaxed. I could even prevent them from noticing a silence had occurred at all. The people in this study didn't have special musical training. Many of them claimed they didn't know anything about music. But their reactions to these pauses revealed that they engaged deeply with passages of classical music, tracking the chord progressions preceding the silence and perceiving the pause accordingly. This is just one of many studies demonstrating that listeners without formal training possess remarkable amounts of implicit knowledge about music, knowledge they evidence behaviorally but cannot articulate conceptually. Musical skills that seem rudimentary, such as clapping to a beat or recognizing a wrong note, can depend on sophisticated mental representations of tonal relationships that many music majors don't learn about until their sophomore year of college. And musical skills that would seem to go beyond rudimentary, such as the ability to be moved to tears by a piece or experience chills in response to it, are shared by wide swaths of the population. If music moves you, the next time someone asks if you know anything about it, think twice before you say no.
That was Lisa Helmuth Margulis of the University of Arkansas. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.